I am a really big proponent of bao buns, especially the Vietnamese ones. And so when I had to register my company's name, I just picked it randomly, and then I just stick with it to create my company's branding around it.
Hello and welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I'm the CEO and co-founder at ProcurementExpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing your SMB spend without buying an ERP, but we're not here to talk about that today. Instead, I've got Milan Gulovic from Bao Contracting. And Milan is based in Eastern Europe. When you're in Western Europe, old Europe, as they call it, you hear about all the cool things that are happening in the East. It's now the roaring part of the European Union. All the growth is happening in the East, and the old Europe feels like getting left behind. So we're going to hear today about if it's really as rosy as it sounds out there. And Milan is going to share some of his experience, starting off with VCs, helping startups. And in particular, we're going to talk about funding a hardware business in the startup phase from zero to hero, which is particularly challenging. So let's hear about that and how you need a good fractional CFO on your team to make that successful. And Milan's going to share how he's helping his client. Milan, you're very welcome to the show. Maybe you can kick things off by telling us something about you that not many people know.
So hi, James. Thanks for having me. Yeah, so one thing that not many people know about me is that I do stand-up comedy as my hobby. So that's something interesting. And the fact that not many people know about this is kind of the fact that I'm not that good at it. So
very good. You're a better CFO than a comic for now.
I hope. Yeah.
And what's the biggest audience you have told a joke in front of?
So I think it was around 200 people in a hotel's lobby where we had like an occasional open mic, and somehow like a big group of international students showed up. So we weren't really expecting that many people, but yeah, it turned out to be around 200.
Okay. And what type of comic are you? Are you a guy who does one-liners, or do you like these witty observations, or...
Yeah, it's a bit of an observation, met surreal comedy, and a little bit of a self-deprecation. Yeah.
Cool. All right. Well, you've set the expectation pretty high now. You're on a podcast, you're a comic, so we better entertain now. Let's bring the jazz hands into the go. You've a little bit of an interesting firm name, Bao, right? So I have to ask, just get that out of the way. The only thing I know is a Bao is a Bao bun, right? Which is like a Eastern food. So where'd you get the name from and why'd you pick it?
That's exactly the origin story. I am a really big proponent of Bao buns, especially the Vietnamese ones. And so when I had to register my company's name, I just picked it randomly, and then I just stick with it to create my company's branding around it. And then after the fact, I found like an acronym. So Bao stands for business as optimal, but in reality, it just comes from the Bao. Yeah.
Very good. I like that story. I thought you were going to reference, I think there's a Pixar movie about character, which we saw that as well. I'd recommend that. Make you cry, actually. Kind of sad.
Yeah, as most Pixar.
Very good. All right. Milan, why are you worth listening to? Well, now tell me a bit about your business career so far, and how come you've managed to call yourself a fractional CFO? How did you come up, and where did you gain your experience?
So I've been working in the financial services industry, give or take 10 years now. So basically, I started out in M&A, so mergers and acquisitions, and then I moved on to work at a Hungarian asset management firm, and I did a short stint in consulting, which didn't really meet my expectations of just putting PowerPoint presentations and logos left and right. So then I got an option to work at a venture fund. So I worked at one of the biggest Hungarian venture capital fund, which is still pretty small if you look at any other competitors in the Western Hemisphere, but I worked there more than 2 years. I was an associate. My main responsibilities were around sourcing and identifying new investment targets and getting the decision-making documents, investment memos to the partners to decide. I really liked it, but as most of these partnership type of situations, it's very big on grinding in the early career. And then once you hit the partner level, you can kind of relax, but it's never really a relaxing job to to be honest. And after around 2 years, I got an opportunity to work at actually a startup. One of my friends went to do an MBA in the US, and his college mate recruited me to work at his early startup as a operations all-rounder at first. So I joined the company as like employee number 9, and we scaled the company up to 56 when I left in more than 18 months or so. And during this time, we raised the Series A funding, and then we continued on working on the product. And while I was there and growing the business, I slowly transitioned into like sort of a head of finance, financial lead position. So that's how I got most of my own like hands-on experience in startups financing side of like the operations and strategic part.
Very good. Okay. So when I hear people starting out in M&A, I'm thinking you were strapped to a phone 5 hours a day, calling founders like me, trying to see if anyone wants to sell their business or build a spreadsheet full of information to try and build a market awareness, I guess. Well, tell us about where you're based, and because it's different doing this in Silicon Valley versus Europe versus where you are. So maybe just tell us what was your task? Who were you calling up? Where were they geographically? What was the strategy?
When I worked in M&A, I was an analyst. So most of the time I got to reach out to people in a cold email. We didn't really do calls. That's a different generation. Our generation does emails. And if all hell breaks loose, we call them up, but we try to avoid that. But we mostly communicated via email, tried to get them to meet us. And then if they signed up for a meeting, then our partners would deliver a presentation about the strategic position and how we see it to be fit to get sold to one of the bigger either competitors or like a private equity firm or a bigger consolidator in the area. Because I was working in Hungary and mostly looking at Hungarian firms, most of the business case was that some Western European consolidator or like a bigger company wants to expand into the geography, and rather than just building up an operation from zero, they prefer to acquire an already established one. And so that was the main things we focused on. I was mostly in the healthcare and telecom sectors in these early years. And yeah, that's how I kind of understood like the technology side of healthcare as well.
Okay. So healthcare was small hospitals you were targeting, of clinics. What about the telecom side? What was that? Chains of retail stores or what else?
For the telco, it was more on the infrastructure side, so like data centers, operators, so telco operators on the wire and on the wireless part. So yeah, that was mainly.
Very good. All right, fair enough. So I love the term analyst because it's cold emailer with a spreadsheet. Okay, that's cool. But that sounds better, but we won't complain about that. But you moved on to an operation. Sounds like a fairly operational role in this startup. You know, finance and operations often go together, whether it's everyone has a job, right? Your job is to do everything, I guess. And then tell us a bit about the VC scene in Hungary. You mentioned it's not super big. Who are the players? What's it like? What do they like to invest in? What are they looking for? Who's funding them? How are they raising their money?
Generally, the Hungarian VC scene is relatively small. I would say there are around 10 established players in the market who are, I would say, market-based or like market-driven, especially in the early stages. So in the seed, pre-seed, or like sometimes even in the like the earlier Series A stages, these VCs try to write checks between like 500,000 to 2 million euros. So it's also already smaller than a typical Western European seed round at first. And it's basically the biggest problem in this region, I would say, is that the market is small, the culture is small, everything is very fragmented. So the very, very early stages of VC investment, so like the seed, pre-seed stage, where there is like maybe a prototype, maybe a product that generates a few thousand euros of revenue each month, it's a very risky business to underwrite because of the growing potential from this region is not that evident compared to like a bigger market. You can scale and get to a bigger audience if you are talking about the consumer side, but you can reach bigger companies as well if you are talking about the B2B software side of business. So because of this, there are a lot of government initiatives to kind of cover this funding gap, which funding gap exists from this like pre-seed to seed stage where it's too risky for market-based VCs to underwrite deals. I would say not so market-based incentivized government actors come into play that can distort the reality of the investment scene. So we kind of got to a point where there was a government institution basically just spraying and praying for every startup to work out, like gave birth to a generation of startupers who were more or less just were relying on these government subsidized funding schemes, which were in names were venture capital, but in reality they were some sort of EU funding, like, you know, wrapped around as, and so that made this early stage very fragile, and it's very hard to do good deals.
And did that make it harder for the, I love the way you're very kindly saying market-based versus non-market-based, basically, right? So let's call it communist and capitalist. So did the communists make it hard for you as a private firm because they were impacting valuations? And I guess it brings a lot of people out of the woodwork with a lot of rubbish ideas, maybe, who just see a couple of a month's paycheck or so on. And so have they gone away from that strategy, or what do you think they should have done instead?
So fortunately, valuations were not that outrageous. The problem was mostly on the supply side of startups, I would say. So as you mentioned, people with like not that good ideas got to get funding. And then these kind of not that scalable startups, they flooded the market. So it was really hard to find the really good deals because you had like the baseline assumption that everything on the market is funded by these government initiatives. And then after a while, it kind of became like a stigma to, you know, just like if that government fund was in that company, we wouldn't even really take a look because we knew their terms. They had very predatory terms in terms of liquidation preferences because, you know, they were putting out EU funds. They had to cover the downside risk very aggressively compared to a market-based VC investor. So, yeah.
That's interesting. I hadn't thought about the term. So not necessarily the valuations, but the preference stack was already messed up by the time you got to them. So you were already second or third, and that just made it impossible.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. Like we released a report at the end of February 2025. It was about how junior mining companies can sometimes take the wrong type of investment. So you may think you're getting, say, convertible debt. You think, oh, it sounds smart, you know, you're non-dilutive and et cetera, but actually it can mess up your preference stack. And it means that you cut yourself off from future funding because you have these guys who are senior to you in the preference stack, and then it makes it very hard to fund later on. So it's kind of non-obvious side effect, if you like. Okay, all right. Well, I guess just one more question on Hungary, because I'm interested. A lot of countries now are trying to attract people in to actually start in countries. I know this is a big thing. I was part of a program in Chile many years ago. I know they do it here in Ireland. They try and encourage people in. Latvia has their digital citizenship, I think, or whatever. And like I mentioned at the top of the show, Eastern Europe has this different attitude, right? It's almost like an attitude feels closer to make America great again. It's more like a Trumpian attitude to business compared to the rest of Europe. So are they successfully encouraging people to move to Hungary? And would you say that's fair, a characterization of the attitude? Because it's not the same as France or Italy or Germany or Ireland, right? It's a different outlook.
Yeah, definitely agree on the outlook part. So people kind of call ourselves a bit of an isolationist, but that's also not that true because then our small open economy is like equally dependent on the Western European imports as on the Far Eastern imports. So it's a bit of a balancing game all the time. But on the encouraging startups in our country, there are some signs. Like we also introduced digital citizenship just last year, I think. So people can now easily come here, stay for 6 months, and then move away. So it's more or less tailored to the digital nomads, so those people who live in like different countries. But the kind of more established businesses are not really choosing Hungary as a base, even though its strategic location is really good, I would say. But yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, let's move on to Bao and Milan. So you've got a case study here of a client, you know, you've got your experience in VC and funding and startups, and you've got a client here, which is, I've heard of direct to consumer and direct, but you've got a direct to farmer client, which I haven't heard of before. Maybe you can tell us a bit about it and the story, how you've been able to help them in their funding and their development.
So the company is started by a couple of early 20s guys and girls, actually. They all have the backgrounds in farming. So their families had farms and everything. And their family farms were struggling with identifying and tracking, keeping track of different pesticides, especially the flying pesticides. You call them like flies, etc. That can cause serious damage to crops and orchards and things like that. So they came up with an idea to create like a smart insect / pesticide trap to track and monitor these species. What is basically is there is like this traditional sticky pads put into like some sort of contraption that has some sort of pheromone inside. So the pheromone lures in the fruit flies, the moths and things like that. And then the usual way is that people just come out there, take a look at the sticky note, and they see that, oh, okay, there is like five more than last week. So that's like an uptrend going now. So this whole process has been automatized by this company. So they have a camera system which can automatically scan, detect, and classify different flies, moths, and everything in this regard that are the most prominent in the European and the American parts. And it seems pretty straightforward, but it's a very big market, and it's very hard to execute a proper solution because of most of the farms are being in very remote locations. So you have to figure out clever ways around like managing data transmission between servers and the client facing part and also the device on premise. So the company was working on this for almost 2 years before they contacted me. They were just doing unit by unit sales. And then they started to talk with a new investor who were really excited about the idea. However, they were doubting the scalability of just unit by unit sales, which is a fair point. And we tried to put together some new sort of business model. So what we ended up doing is that we basically were managed to bring down the unit cost of the sensor packages. And so basically now the main cost item is just the camera and like the whole sensor package. And then we have a 3D, not a 3D printed, but like a very easily assemblable contraption, which is from a sheet of plastic. So you can just set it up very quickly, very easily, very cheaply. So the whole thing costs around, I would say in terms of bill of materials, we are below the 50 euro line right now. We are trying to sell it on a kind of a minimum margin just to cover our cost of production and our R&D and some of the, you know, related costs. And then we employ a subscription fee on top of it because we have a mobile app, but also it has access to the larger network of traps. So if another farmer picks up a new swarming of a moth or a fly that comes towards your farm, you get a notification. Of course, data is anonymized and everything alongside the whole network. But this is the main idea, that this has like a more of a longitudinal forecasting capability. So my job was to come up with this new business model and try to work down the cost on the bill of materials to fit this new business model. Yeah.
So you're a farmer and you get a notification on your phone that the bugs are coming. What do? Get a flamethrower, run outside and start like, what is the remediation? How do you know what's happening?
So the idea is that normally farmers put these pesticides, repellents and chemicals on their crops on a regular basis. And if they can have a timely notification of these swarms or new types coming in, they could just increase the pesticides distribution and not use pesticides just in the other time. So in overall, the goal is to reduce pesticides use and just basically make it more actionable.
Okay, interesting. I mean, there's a cost saving. You're using fewer pesticides as well. I can see farmers, color me cynical, be more enthusiastic about the cost saving than the green credentials, because the it depends on who they are, I guess, but like it's easier to sell. Everyone wants to save money on their costs and then have the subscription is cheaper. So you say hardware, I think heartache, because it's just an extra thing to go wrong. They break down to distribute and it's, you know, it's a problem. So you mentioned the addition of the subscription. Is before you came along, were they just selling it like for whatever, $150 for the actual hardware, and they didn't have a subscription component, but you realized, no, this is never going to work because of the volumes involved? Or how did you figure out what they were trying just couldn't work?
Yeah, exactly. They were doing, they had like another type of product variant, which was much more expensive. So it was much more rugged. It came with like a big box and everything. And they were selling it on a unit by unit basis. So they realized the one time revenue and then just tried to sell another unit and so on. So when I came along, there was already some strategic discussions in-house to switch to this new model. But I basically made the business case, and also the investors helped out with their own inputs to like put together like a feasible path to fundraise, to transition into this new business model, and then to scale this new business model.
Yeah. Okay. So you've come up with a business model, which is great, but there's investors who've handed over their hard-earned cash. So how much of your attention and interest goes into tracking that cash within the business versus helping? So this is, the CFO role is a little bit tricky one, right? You have responsibilities to the investors, and you have to obviously get along with the founders. You have to make the business successful. It's kind of like this diplomatic role where you have different masters, if you like. Yeah. Tell me about that. How do you balance that? And if it really came down to it, where does your loyalty lie?
Yeah, I mean, it's a weird part because sometimes I get contracted by the investors to go and work with one of their portfolio companies to help with them with some sort of strategic decision, or even just with the operational cash management. But the other times I got contracted by the startup directly. That kind of alleviates the problem of who is whose master. But in terms of cash management and strategic decisions and just basically supporting strategic initiatives, I would say when I started out, it was around 70-30 in terms of like when we were doing the fundraising, it was 70% strategic and then 30% operational. And then when we closed the fundraising, then it transitioned into around 50-50. But then we started to automate most of the stuff. It's a very small operation, so it's like 15 people, and we don't really have that much of a big of a cost items besides the manufacturing. So we were able to automate most of the reporting and everything using very basic Excel sheets and integrations. So it's not a very big deal. And now it's again around 70% strategic and around 30% operational on my end, because now we are also working towards a new fundraising round. So that's again needs some more attention.
Okay. All right. Well, maybe you and I should have a conversation around spend control when they get a bit bigger. But to that point, where are they now in the funding? What's happened now that they've got their first few clients and got this subscription model going? What role did you play in the fundraising, and what level of fundraising have they been successful in achieving?
So the fundraising was a Series Seed. It was around 2 million euros. Part of it was a fresh capital injection into the company. Part of it was for cap table cleaning. There were some ex-co-founders and some early business angels who wanted to get out. So in this part, we needed to allocate some of the funds to clear out the cap table for, first of all, future fundability, and also just so everyone is on the same page. So I helped with these part of the tracks, of the financing tracks. And I also basically helped with putting together the new business plan, the new business model, which basically gave us the idea of how much money we really need to raise. And it was good because the investors were very open to feedback and targeting the actual cash need, and not just saying that, okay, you are a seed company, you have a valuation, I don't know, 5 million, then we give you $1 million. Is it enough or not? We don't care. They were very open to kind of adjust their investment size and their valuation targets and expectations so our cap table stays healthy. So we had to manage this kind of relationship as well. To once we cleaned up the cap table, then we wouldn't want to mess it up again with too aggressive investors. Yeah.
Interesting. So I love the euphemisms that CFOs use for stuff like this, like secondary, cleaning up the cap table. Let's call it what it is. It's buying people off, cashing out.
Yes.
This is the fun part, right? This is what the entrepreneurs are here for. Ding-a-ding-a-ding. Yeah. I'm an entrepreneur, right? So they cleaned up or they paid off early stage investors with cash. Now, that's a question of, because we actually did this at very early days of Procurement Express. We had a third partner between me and Rich. We paid off or whatever, cleaned up or provided secondary or however you want to call it for this guy who was working with us, Jerry, still out there. But so did the existing founders get to partake because, or was this something that was only available for giving up the equity? Yeah.
Yes, it was just for old co-founders who were like kind of strayed out of the business and some of the very, very early angels who provided like, I don't know, the first 10,000 euros.
And roughly, did those first angels, I mean, they sold, so it must have been worth their while. What sort of return were they able to make?
I'm not sure because I don't know the initial valuation, but I think they made at least 2-2.5x their money. Yeah, in 3 years or so. But yeah.
Not bad. Okay, well, that's good. When angels, like 8 out of 10 times, you don't get anything back. 5 out of 10 times. So, you know, that's a two bagger is fine.
Exactly.
All right. Okay. So very good. It's a nice case study. It's good. And so tell me a bit, is this the ideal customer for you now? Like, do you want more of these customers or who is your chef's kiss perfect customer that you would like to do more business with?
So my area of expertise lies in these seed pre-seed companies. I can provide the most value here. And basically how I like to operate with companies that I come in, I help with some sort of strategic project. We see how we work together. And if the chemistry is good, then I can stay on and do the more operational part of the financing. I actually have a small team now. Two interns who can help me with more of the administrative part. I can do some of the relationship management and everything. So once we establish like a working, like an ongoing schedule or like a business as usual schedule, I usually work on a retainer rate. And after you need some new start of strategic initiative, for example, getting ready for a new fundraising or something, I can also help with that. Again, my ideal profile is a pre-seed seed company in the Central Eastern European region, but I'm open to any jurisdiction where I understand.
Very good. Okay. And what's the best way for people to find you?
So they can add me on LinkedIn. My name is Milan Golovic. It's pretty easy to find, or you can just send me an email at milan@bauconsulting.eu. So that's, again, something where I'm pretty responsive.
Very good, Milan. All right. So I have one question I ask every guest before I let them go, which is, who is your business hero and why?
Okay. So my business hero is Stephen A. Schwarzman. He is the founder of Blackstone. I really like his idea of starting something out of nothing in terms of the services business. So he started the services business, which grew into becoming one of the biggest alternative asset management firms in the world. So they started with M&A advisory and slowly using their own cash flow and their own network built out new and new initiatives, and they managed to grow pretty substantively. So that's kind of my long-term goal as well. Not on that scale as Stephen A. Schwarzman did, but something similar, but smaller.
Well, why not? You know, like I'm a couple of years older than you. And one thing I do regret is I didn't believe in myself more when I was younger. Like, funny enough, I pretty much always got what I thought I would get, even though I thought it was impossible at the time. So if I can give my unsolicited advice, is to don't limit yourself. Maybe eclipse Blackstone. Why not?
Yeah, I will take that.
All right, Milan, this has been a lot of fun chatting to you. Thanks for being such good fun on the podcast. And thank you for listening this far. If you're still listening, then your special reward for getting this far into the show is to be able to go to procurementexpress.com/newsletter. Now, it's not just an ordinary newsletter. We have revamped it this week. Well, actually, since early February, we've been now including stories from the recent financial press. It's basically in this whole trend of fraud, abuse and omissions that have been going on in the States. We're starting to pick up some of these news stories and put them in the newsletter. So why would you be interested in that? Well, let's face it, they're fun. It's nice to hear about people messing up, but also you can also learn something for your client. You've got stories about how SMBs, local business and small government have been making mistakes that anyone could really fall into. Anything from accounting to mistakes to impropriety, and stories which can help as a warning to the rest of us and potentially a warning to your client. So for that reason, and also to keep up with the rest of our podcast, you can sign up at procurementexpress.com/newsletter. Milan, you've been great. Thanks very much for being on the show.
Thank you.